Retina Rounds, podcast number 5. In this week's podcast, Dr. Stephen Schwartz interviews Dr. Jack Wells, former vice chair for the DRCRNet, ophthalmology department chair at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, managing member of Palmetto Retina Center in Columbia, South Carolina, and a leader in clinical trials. Dr. Wells talks about his formative years under the mentorship of Tom Auberg, Alan Berg, and Zdenek Gregor, how he got involved in clinical trials, and the professional satisfaction that participation in research has brought to his career. He also reviews some of the key learnings from the DRCRNet trials and the tips that he provides to fellows in training. Let's check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Retina Rounds Weekly Podcast. We are delighted to have Jack Wells from Columbia, South Carolina, joining us today. Jack is one of the leading retinologists in the United States, having built one of the great private practices in America and participating in both clinical and basic science research throughout his career, including being, director or clinical director of the Diabetic Research and Clinical Trials Network, the DRCR, for a number of years, and having described some important diseases, and we'll get into all of that. But most importantly, Jack is just an all-around great guy, and I'm sure that we'll learn a lot and enjoy listening to him today. Jack, welcome to Retina Rounds.
Steve, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a privilege, and it's been a lot of fun the last 30 plus years, and a lot of it's been with you. So yeah. I'm happy to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for making the time. Can we start out by hearing a little bit about how you came into ophthalmology? I had the great pleasure of meeting your father, and I think it would be really nice to hear your genesis story into ophthalmology and retina.
Sure. So my father was a general ophthalmologist and practiced here in Columbia, South Carolina for 43 years. Obviously, great guy, always happy. But I went to medical school thinking I wanted to be a trauma surgeon. I think I watched too many episodes of MASH growing up, and I thought that was going to be exciting and a way to go. But I pretty quickly learned that probably didn't suit my personality. And after several steps in several different directions, I thought to myself one day, my father's got a really nice life. As an ophthalmologist, maybe ophthalmology would be a good thing to do. So after a couple of years of internal medicine, I switched to ophthalmology and really had planned to go into practice with my dad. But about my second year of residency, some of my great mentors, Paul Sternberg, Tom Auberg, Travis Meredith at Emory at the time, really got me interested in retina. And I thought to myself, I'll just do a medical retina fellowship and then I'll go back to Columbia and work with Dad, and that'll satisfy that. And at Tom Auberg's urging, I went to London and did a medical retina fellowship with Alan Bird, which is how I met you. Obviously, and that year in London really changed my life, my professional life. Eventually wound up, after a couple of years working with my dad, going back to Moorfields and doing a surgical fellowship with Zden Gregor. You and I did the same fellowships, and you know how great that was. And so it was really just kind of, I think, the serendipity of Tom Auberg saying to me, you should really go to London and spend a year with Alan Bird. And it really just changed what I wanted to do.
What were the things that Tom and Paul and Travis, which by the way are one of the great faculties of the ages, what was it that they were doing in retina that so captivated you that you could change life course like that?
I think it was the fluorescein angiography conference that Paul Sternberg ran every Friday morning. It was just so well done, and it was the beauty of the images and the organization of your thought and interpreting these things, and there were a lot of mysteries back then too, a lot of times you didn't know what it was, and the discussions and taking, the histopathologic knowledge of the retina and sort of correlating that with what you were seeing on the angiogram. I just thought it was fascinating. And, and we did a lot of that at Moorfields with Alan. And I would actually say that more than the surgery was really what caught my fancy. The surgery that, when you're a resident, they didn't let you do anything. You basically held contact lenses and cut sutures and often got fussed at for not doing it right. So I would say it was really those conferences at Emory with Paul.
You remember how long those surgeries were that you were assisting in back in those days?
I mean, hours and hours. It seems like 2, 3 hours.
Right.
We go to
Right.
the OR first thing in the morning and leave late at night. I mean, it just went on forever.
That's right. And when you got to London, what was it about that fellowship that changed your life?
So the medical retina year with Alan Bird, I just remember the first week I was in London, I saw 4 patients with von Hippel-Lindau, tumors in their eye. And I was like, I've only read about this. I've never seen one in my life, and I've seen 4 in 1 week. And then as the year went on, as you know, just the incredible pathology that was coming into Moorfields really from all over the world. And so you just saw everything. A lot of stuff that you really, I've never really seen again. But I think the moment that really impacted me the most and sort of I knew that I wasn't going to be happy just being in private practice in Columbia, South Carolina. I was like, was, we had seen this family in the fall of 1991 that had what people at the time called central areolar choroidal dystrophy. And that this family had this condition and it sort of dominantly inherited. And about 8 months later, I was in clinic and, Marcel J., one of the geneticists, came running into clinic and says, the Cashmore family has a periphery mutation. And I was looking at her like, what's a periphery mutation? I had no idea what she was talking about. And, we wound up publishing that in Nature Genetics. And it was a issue of Nature Genetics that had the first three publications of macular disease, knowing the genetic mutation. They were all periphery mutations. I can't remember all the different groups now. I know Ed Stone's group from Iowa had one of the papers, but I got a brief moment of sort of notoriety from that. I remember going to ARVO and having some Japanese medical students coming to ask him for my autograph, and I was like, oh wow. They've actually read the paper. But I knew at that point, I was like, I'm never going to be satisfied just grinding it out at home. I'm going to want to stay involved somehow in, clinical research. I knew I wouldn't, my background was not basic science, but I knew at that point that I had to continue to be involved in clinical research.
Well,
And
that's right.
then,
Go ahead.
no, and then I was going to say, you were instrumental actually in giving me my first opportunity in 2000, 2001, right around in there, when iTech, who a lot of listeners may not really remember, but iTech had the first anti-VEGF agent, Macugen. I think it was approved in 2004. And the phase three trial for that, thanks to you, I got chosen to be a site. And our clinical research program, started there and it was off and running. And it's been about a 25-year joyride. We've had a great success with it and a great time doing it and been involved in a lot of exciting things.
I'm so glad that that's all worked out. Let's go back to that moment of applying basic science to a clinical observation and learning about the periphery RDS mutation and what happens. I remember Alan drawing the fold in the outer segment of the rods
Didn't stay positive bend in
the
the
curve, yeah, and being all excited about it. But it was really Alan's infectious love for basic science and then applying it to the observations that infected all of us. And I wonder if you can just expound on that moment where you start to understand the basic science and how it might apply to the human in your chair.
Yeah, I mean, I envied Alan so much for his basic science knowledge. I mean, I've said repeatedly, I mean, he knew more basic science, when it came to the eye than any clinician I've ever known. I mean, he was an amazing scientist, basic scientist. In addition to being a really good observer on, like when he would do an exam, I mean, he was an excellent observer of the eye exam in clinic. Of course, we didn't have OCT back then, so it was a different world. We were using contact lenses to, sort of get this, to view the macula and see fluid and things like that. So he always just amazed me, and I always, was jealous. I wish that I'd had that ability, and I didn't, but he was my hero because of that.
Well, he was all of he's still all of our heroes, and all of he's a hero to a whole generation of people. And he was a great observer. I remember the patient that he used to convince Don Gass that RPE tears actually existed. He finally found one without a hemorrhage, and you could see the neurosensory retina above some fluid, and then a big tear in the RPE, and you could just see right through it. I'm sure you remember that series of pictures, the old double Kodak slide picture.
I do.
It's seared in our memory. One of the great things about that fellowship, besides the emphasis on the importance of basic science and how it translated into clinical work and being able to help patients, was also the collegiality of the group. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, that was the other thing that I was so pleasantly surprised by when I went over there, was that I'd never met Alan Bird. I didn't know really that much about him. I just went because my chairman, Tom Auberg, said it's a great fellowship. And so I sort of had this preconceived notion that he was going to be this very haughty Englishman, that would be kind of arrogant, and if, he would be hard on me. And he turned out to be such the exact opposite. I mean, he was just the most genuine, welcoming, humorous. I mean, he was just so much fun to be with, and he had this enthusiasm in clinic every day. And you remember, the highlight, one of the highlights was, the Monday morning going in and sitting around the fluorescein table. We had this big table that was a big light box. Nobody uses those anymore, but we would sit around and pass around angiograms and talk about them, and the way he would, dissect these angiograms and teach you how to think about them was just, priceless.
He was really amazing. The fact that he took years out of his career to go and do basic science sabbaticals, one at UCLA, which was how I got to know him, and others at different places. And of course, he was exceptionally trained. And besides his superior intellect and in personality, you hit it right on the head, that infectious love of joy from what he did. And then, of course, that trickled down into the collegiality of the group of people that were co-fellows with you.
Yes, we had great. We had, people from Germany, people from all over, and very well-known people. I had the fortune of working with, like, Frank Holz and Robin Geimer, who are, really leading people in the macular world these days. So that was great, to have that experience of interacting with these international colleagues and remaining friends with them to this day. It's been over 30 years now, and it's great to see them at meetings and so forth. And the other thing I forgot to mention about Alan that was great was that he'd love to go to the pint and go to the pub and have a pint with you. It was fun. He was fun to be with.
He was amazing and a great leader. And let's not leave out, Alex Harper and Thomas Wolfenberger and the rest of that cohort of fellows. It was the age of giants. We were really lucky to make those friends, and those friendships last a long time. And so you really made your career choice based on the advice of a mentor, and it was a great decision for you. And when did it dawn on you, when you were a fellow, the medical retinologists in England and in Europe were very distinct from the surgical retinologists. There were very few who crossed over into both worlds. And when did you decide that you needed to be a retina surgeon, that you were a surgeon at heart? When did it strike you?
Well, when I came up from my fellowship with Alan Bird in the summer of 1992, and went to work with my dad, and I sort of had this notion that I could, do medical retina in addition to doing general ophthalmology in my dad's practice. But I quickly realized, my dad was the competition with people in town. Nobody was going to send me patients, And I also pretty quickly realized that I really didn't want to be a general ophthalmologist. And so I thought, the only way I can do this is I got to go back and do a surgical fellowship and learn to be a retina surgeon so that I can just leave my dad's practice and open my own practice and, just make a retina-only practice. And so, again, credit to you. You were in the middle of doing your fellowships over there, and you had actually contacted me and talked about how wonderful Sten Gregor's retina surgical fellowship was over there, and convinced me that I needed to do it. And so I applied and fortunately got offered the spot. And that was a very different year from being a fellow with Alan Bird, but it was an amazing, fantastic year. And Sten was such an amazing teacher in the OR, and just calm and never critical and encouraging. And
I
he
think
really
that's because he used all his anxiety and criticism on me before he got to you.
yeah, you've told me that before. Maybe so, I don't know. But anyway, so that was a great year, lots of surgery. One of the reasons why I went over there was I actually looked around at some fellowships in the States, and I was talking to the fellows and they were getting 100 cases or something like that, and you were telling me 400 or 500 cases, and I was like, well, good Lord, I want to go to London and do a lot of surgery, not go somewhere in America and do a little bit of surgery. I want to leave my fellowship feeling very comfortable that I can do this on my own. And that's exactly what happened. So it was great.
Yeah, I consider Sten to be one of the great, Sten Gregor to be one of the great mentors in my life. He surgically, he was able to walk in both worlds of, and over there, very much a Renaissance man because medical and surgical retina were so separate. And he actually lived in both worlds and had clinics in both services and was well respected across the board and just a very, very original thinker. And honestly, one of the best surgeons I've ever seen. And
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of surgeons, and
No,
so.
I always remember, and maybe I don't know if y'all were the first to describe it, but the identification of that posterior lamella in diabetic TRDs, traction retinal detachments, is so critical to the vitreous schisis, because y'all wrote the paper, and I know some of my partners don't really recognize that. I've tried to talk to them about it, but it's so important to recognize that, to be in the right surgical plane. And Sten, I don't know, were y'all the first to really write about
Well,
that?
I was lucky enough to be gifted that original observation of his, probably after I made a few holes on a few delaminations and or attempted delaminations, and Sten showed me the secret passage into the plane between the neurosensory retina and the fibrovascular proliferation, and it was like a magic door. And once you knew the way in and recognized it, and he actually had made the observation and then showed me. He was such a voracious reader. He had showed me the different places in the literature that some of the great surgeons, Ivanovich and others, had talked about it. There was a some people thought it was fibrin, some people thought it was like an epiretinal membrane. But what we did is we took it out of the eye in sections and stained it and showed that it was in fact vitreous, and it made the cover of ophthalmology, and it was a big deal for me. And I got a lot of credit for it, but really it was all Sten. But it's great. It's a great way to, when you're a fellow and you have a faculty member who puts the trainees first, and they know that they're going to unleash a career of excitement by letting somebody participate at that first authorship level and give the presentations. And one of the, I came back to Los Angeles and gave a paper at UCLA at one of our symposia, celebrating Brad Strassman and Norm Beyer and Bob Foose and Buzz Krieger. And it was one of the first things I did when I got there was celebrated that generation. And I gave that paper, and Tom Aabberg happened to be there. And I came off the podium and walked to my chair, and Tom looked at me and said, "Nice paper." And for me, that compliment has stuck with me for, however many years, because Tom was, parsimonious with his praise and
Quiet man.
quiet man. And so that was a big deal for me. And he, of course, was one of the giants in diabetic vitreoretinal surgery. And so Zden was a great mentor. And then you came back to South Carolina, and one of the things that's of interest to our audience, especially the trainees, is this decision on whether to go into academia and whether to go into private practice, whether to have an academic private practice, whether to have a business private practice. And none of the choices are bad. They're all good choices. They all fit for different people. And whether to go geographically, to go home or not. And so could you talk about that a little bit? Did you have to go home? Did you think about, I know you're a pretty worldly guy, and you love some metropolitan areas, and I wonder, there you are in the center of South Carolina. I know there's a long family history there. Speak to that a little bit, that decision process.
So we considered, I considered some jobs elsewhere. I was offered an opportunity to stay in London. But then, after really thinking about it, I had three small children. My wife and I were both from Columbia, had dated since high school. Both of our families were here in Columbia. And we really just made the conscious decision that we wanted to come back home. There was just too many family and friends. And we didn't really want to live somewhere where we didn't know anybody. We just had opportunities here because of family connections that we would probably never have somewhere else. So it was a lifestyle decision more than anything else. And I came back, and then, for a while I was a little bit despairing because I thought, I knew I wanted to get involved in clinical research, but I was striking out. I was trying here and there, and really, if it hadn't been for you, I'm not sure I ever would have gotten there. But once, I never regretted it once we finally got this research program in our practice going. Because then I had the excitement of that, because that truly made practice much more exciting and interesting to me than just going into the office and seeing your patients and then going home, and that's kind of the end of it. So you wanted to be a part of the effort by the research community to improve things. And so it was very exciting to be a part of that effort. And so I
It's
never,
that need to give back.
yes, exactly. And I've never regretted coming back to Columbia. If I had never gotten involved in research here in Columbia, I'm not sure I would have stayed. I think I might have gotten too itchy and too unhappy to have stayed my whole career here. But fortunately, it all worked out, and we managed to make it happen here. So our practice, the first 5 years was basically pretty straight, a straight small. I was by myself. It was a one-man retina practice. Then once we got the research program going, we needed more doctors, and it slowly started growing. And
And
now
look at you now.
look at it. I mean, I think there's like 12 doctors now over Central South Carolina and Augusta, Georgia, basically Eastern Georgia. So it's grown a lot, and the trial program has grown a lot.
Let's talk a little bit about the trial program. You've been a part of just about every major advance in retina, both on the imaging side and on the pharmacology side. And a lot of those were industry sponsored trials, and you've been a huge contributor. And you give me credit for bringing you into it, but the truth was, I knew, and I got so much credit for bringing in such a great site, great recruiter, quality in, quality out, great data, never an issue with your site from you. And that was all fantastic. So thank you for that. But let's talk about your decision to volunteer and participate in the DRCR trials, because that is not an industry-sponsored group. That's a National Institute of Health group, which can have extra layers of bureaucracy and frustration and less remuneration for your time. So it's a much bigger time commitment, but it does give you the advantage of, when you get to the level that you got to as director of the program, of designing the trials. So Do you remember thinking about whether or not to do that? And you can leave out the part about what I told you.
Yeah. Well, I think, as I recall, I think the DRCR was chartered and established in like 2003, and it was around 2004. I was at a meeting, and I can't remember who I was talking to now. And somebody, I didn't even know about it. I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. A diabetic research network. And the DRCR was recruiting sites. And I think shortly thereafter, I got some letter or an email. And I thought to myself, we should participate in this. I mean, there's some very, prominent names, Lloyd Allo and people like that that were, starting this thing. And I said, this looks to me like this is going to be an important part of ongoing diabetic eye disease research, and we should get involved. And they were, of course, happy to have us. I mean, they weren't very selective. They were trying to get sites, and so we got going, and we enrolled well in their early studies. I think most notably, like Protocol I, which I don't know if everybody, the DRCR, labels their protocols alphabetically. They're in the double letters now, but Protocol I was, really a pivotal study because it showed, for the first time that anti-VEGF therapy was better than focal laser treatment for diabetic macular edema. I mean, that had never been shown before. And it was, and we had enrolled really well in that study, which, whether you're working for the DRCR or an industry, enrollment is what gets you attention. You enroll a lot of patients and you do it cleanly. You don't make a lot of mistakes. They're going to reward you with more studies or ask you to present at meetings or ask you to be an author on a paper. Or in the DRCR case, they invited me to be on a protocol development committee for a study. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. So I did that. And, and then we continued to enroll. And then ultimately, I wasn't actually the director. I was a vice chair. There were three vice chairs and a chair. And I was one of the vice chairs for a period of time, about 3 years. And it was also during that time that I, got invited to chair, be the protocol chair for the Protocol T, which was the comparative study of Eylea, Avastin, and Lucentis for DME, which consumed about 4 years of my life, but very exciting thing to do. It involved a lot of travel. The headquarters of the DRCR is in Tampa, and I think I went to Tampa like, 15 times that every year, those 4 years. I mean, I was always flying to Tampa for the day and flying back. So it was a sacrifice because I had to, miss a day of clinic, which I wasn't getting paid really to do this. I think there was a small remuneration, but not much. There was a lot of sacrifice of time, like with phone calls at night or during the middle of the day. But to me, it was all worth it. You mentioned earlier, it was like being, given back. And, that was true because the remuneration for those trials was not the same as industry trials. And we did have some internal dissent in the practice. Some of the people didn't think we should do them because of, or we should not enroll in them because of the money difference. But I'm glad that we did. And I think that the DRCR, really changed. I know that it changed the management of diabetic retinopathy complications through a number of their studies. And it's
Well,
things that.
let me interrupt you there. Let's talk
Yeah.
about that in particular, because I'm sure you'll be too modest if I don't push you. And that is, what do you think the, let's say, three or four biggest changes in the practice management of diabetic retinopathy that came were, these weren't necessarily original ideas that the DRCR folks had, but what they were was prospective randomized clinical trials, high level, high validity evidence that actually impacted the way the management of these conditions is recommended. So can you just run down what you think the big practice changes were, at least for you, from the DRCR?
Well, I mean, with the approval of newer agents like Vabysmo and high dose Eylea. Some of the results of the protocol T are not quite as apropos as they used to be. But at the time when the results, the 2 year results of protocol T clearly showed that Eylea was, better at reducing edema and improving vision in eyes with baseline vision 20/50 or worse. That was a big thing. At the time, that was a major finding. We knew that we had one drug that was better in these worse vision, eyes. But I think an underlooked fact of that study that I think about all the time, or think about it in practice, because we have a lot of step therapy and a lot of, insurance companies require us to start with Avastin in DME eyes, and they don't really distinguish what the vision is. But when you look at the results of protocol T from the imaging results, even in the good vision eyes, the eyes with 20/40 or better vision at baseline, where the vision outcomes were the same regardless of all three drugs, the Avastin eyes, the OCT was reduced 50% less than the others. And that was true in the worsening eyes too. So Avastin doesn't reduce the edema nearly as well as the other agents, even though the vision outcomes were the same. And so I just, I always say I don't think Avastin is an appropriate choice for diabetic macular edema. You don't reduce the edema as well, regardless of what the vision is. So you can't convince insurance companies of that. And then I think the other, I'll just say maybe two other things that I use now regularly. And I was not involved in this study, but Protocol V was the study where they took eyes with 20/25 or better vision with center-involved DME, and they randomized them to either starting with Eylea injections or focal laser treatment or observation. And the reason why they did that was that none of the industry studies, none of the agents, included eyes with good vision at baseline. You had to have some vision loss at baseline. So the reasoning was, we want to do a study, and because you see these people in clinic all the time. You see a diabetic with, a 400 micron central thickness on the OCT and 20/20 vision. You go, what do I do with, they got good vision, but they got horrible edema. And so that protocol B showed at the end of 2 years. So the primary outcome was the percentages of eyes that lost one line of vision over 2 years. And so you got the arm that got treated with Eylea, you got the laser arm. If they got worse, they got treated with Eylea. And the observation arm, if they got worse, they got treated with Eylea. And at the end of 2 years, the percentage of eyes that lost a line of vision was the same in all three groups. It was 16 to 18%. And so the takeaway for me from that was, there's no harm in waiting. So if you've got an eye with good vision and center-involved DME, and they're 20/20, there is no harm in just observing them and initiating treatment if their vision drops. So that's what I do with those eyes now. I know people may disagree with that, but that's what I took from that study, and that's how I practice now. And then, the other thing is, PRP, Protocol S, that compared Lucentis injections to PRP for, high risk PDR. That ultimately the outcome was good in either group. You could go either way. But there were two things out of the study. If you have coexisting DME and eyes with active PDR, and you treat those eyes with PRP first, their DME is going to get worse and they're going to lose vision. Now, we knew that before the study, but it was pretty clear in that trial that using PRP first in eyes with center-involved DME is not a good idea, because the eyes that got Lucentis injections instead of PRP that had center-involved DME, they did well. And then the vision loss, that was documented with PRP, it was fairly significant. I mean, there was a huge difference at 2 years, and the eyes that got PRP at baseline had like a 430 decibel loss in their visual field at 2 years versus like 25 or something like that in the Lucentis treated group. So there was massive visual field loss. Now, when they followed those eyes for 3 more years or up to 5 years, the Lucentis group lost more visual field over the ensuing 3 years, but never reached the degree that the laser group had lost. So I basically treat PDR with injections now. I rarely do laser. I do laser. I give people sort of like one missed visit. If they miss one visit, I'll give them one. If they miss a second one and they come back, I'll laser them. I'm saying, you're not reliable. But I generally avoid PRP for most of my PDR patients
How
now.
often do you find you have to treat those patients over time?
So most of my PDR patients are getting a shot every 3 or 4 months.
For perpetuity.
Once they get their, induction of, a monthly injection 2 or 3 times and everything looks regressed, I extend them out. And most of them settle into an every 3, some 4 month. Yeah, I
And
mean, I just keep doing it.
you're an observing guy. Do you look at their retinal mid periphery and periphery for ischemia? Do you ever see it reperfuse? Do you
No,
ever do you ever
I don't do angiograms. I do a baseline, but I don't repeat them very often. The reason why I do an angiogram at baseline is that there's a lot of MV you don't see clinically. I mean, you do an angiogram and you're going, wow, I didn't see all that MV. You can look and miss a lot of it. So I generally get an angiogram at baseline just so I know where the MV is.
And that's an ultra wide field Optose angiogram.
Yeah, and then when they come back in for their follow-up appointments, we take an Optose image and we look at the color photograph and we, honestly look at the photograph more than the patient almost. I mean, we look at it with red free. We put the red free on because I think you can see the MV better when it's red free than color, and we look for recurrences. And if we see recurrences, we push, reduce the interval. If we don't, we stay with it. If they bleed, we reduce the interval. As long as they're not bleeding, we don't. So that's pretty much how I manage
And what about
PDR.
targeted? So you're not a fan or haven't done much of the targeted retinal photocoagulation?
I've tried it some. I know y'all wrote about that years ago, and I definitely tried it, and I've tried it in BRVO eyes too. And just haven't, didn't really, I don't know, I didn't really think it was that helpful.
It's not different. It doesn't make a difference for patients who are coming in. It makes a big difference for patients who disappear.
Right.
And
I can believe that.
I think it's different in here in the fourth world in California, which is the third world inside the first world. We don't always have people that have a linear healthcare journey through no fault of their own. They're bouncing between employers or whatever, and they have trouble coming back in, or providers, and it becomes a challenge for them to follow up. And so we tend here to strike while the iron is hot, try and control the DME and the NV, and give them as low a dose of targeted photocoagulation. It doesn't last them forever, but it often lasts them for a while. They'll have progressive ischemia. Let me ask you this. Have you seen a difference in the incidence of severe retinopathy, or even moderate retinopathy, with the GLP-1 inhibitors, the weight loss drugs?
I've had a couple of people ask me this, and honestly, I guess, maybe it's just too busy every day, but I haven't really tried to make that association. Honestly, I just haven't really thought about it that much.
When you think about starting a practice, when you go back and recall starting a practice, what imaging devices made the biggest difference for you over the course of your early career? Obviously, OCT was very impactful, but those first generation OCTs that you probably had weren't that great. So, was it the Optose machine? Was it the high resolution OCTs? What was it for you that just changed your world in terms of what you were able to image?
Well, when I started in practice, I didn't have a photographer, and I had to send people. There was an ophthalmic photographer at the hospital next to my office. And he was just a medical photographer, but he had a fundus camera and he was actually pretty good. So, in the mid late 90s, if I wanted photographs or an angiogram, I had to write an order, send the patient, call, make them an appointment. They had to go over to the hospital. They had to, they get their imaging. And then, they had to send the film out to be developed. And then, like sometimes a week later, I'd get this package in the mail and I'd open it up and it would be the angiograms, the transparencies, and you'd look at them on a light box. And I mean, it was very cumbersome. And I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. I can't, it's too slow. I sometimes, I want some information faster. And so when I was at Moorfields, I had been exposed to an SLO, to a scanning laser ophthalmoscope. And I started hearing about the Heidelberg Engineering and that they had this scanning laser ophthalmoscope. This was like 1997-ish. And Frank Holtz, who I mentioned earlier, who was in Heidelberg at the time, he was, one of our co-fellows. And Frank was early in his career and operating every day, but he was still amazingly doing all this great research. And I think I called Frank on the phone. You forget this was before really email and everything. And I got him on the phone and I was like, "Hey, I'm thinking about buying one of these Heidelbergs. What do you think?" And he says, "Oh yeah, you should come over and look at it because the company wouldn't put one in my office for me to test it." So, but they did fly me to Heidelberg, and I got to spend the day with Frank in clinic and see this SLO. And the thing that struck me about it was that it was so user friendly. It was so you didn't have to be a photographer, you didn't have to really know how to take photographs of the retina with a fundus camera to get images. I mean, you could just anybody could do it. And I thought, this will be perfect. I'll teach one of my girls, I'll inject the fluorescein and I'll stand there and I'll teach her how to do it. And ultimately she'll be able to do it. And I'll have the images right there on the screen. And so I bought it. Good Lord, it was like $100,000. And in 1997, I didn't have any money. I was like, I cannot believe I'm borrowing 100 grand to buy this SLO. And it was fantastic. I mean, I never had to send anybody out for an angiogram again. We had it all right there. We got ICG. We went from the HRA1 to the HRA2. And I never had to have a, I mean, ultimately we did get a trained photographer and we had a fundus camera and everything, but that was a major advance for me in the late 90s. And then yeah, OCT, good Lord, that just changed everything. But currently the Optos has, the wide angle angiography and color photography of the Optos has been just fantastic for managing diabetic retinopathy in my mind. I mean, I just think it's awesome. And you can, I find myself, I'll be very open about it. I find myself looking at the photograph as much or more than the patient sometimes, because when I'm looking, I want to know, is that retinopathy severity changing? Is it getting worse? Is it getting better? And I can put the images side by side and look, as opposed to looking at the patient. I mean, I'll look at the retina real quickly with an indirect, but I don't study it quite as closely as I used to because I've got the OCT and I've got the Optos image right there on the screen. And so the exam is more for like looking at vitreoretinal relationships. And instead of like diabetic severity or looking for NV or DME, you don't have to really look at the macula now to remember how we used to put a contact lens on and say, I think there's edema. I think it's swollen right here. We don't do that anymore.
No,
So
it is a game changer.
I would think the SLO and, obviously OCT and then the wide angle imaging is just phenomenal.
Have
And
you guys?
I have not adopted OCT angiography. I have to admit that. It seemed like to me it was going to be a time burden to add to my already busy day to try to, interpret OCTA imaging. And plus a burden on my already overworked OCT technicians, who are trying to do 200 OCTs a day. So I don't know about you. I don't know if you've adopted OCTA, but I have not.
Well, I've been practicing with, OCTA gurus around the corner from me, meaning around the hallway, and they're
You are right there.
seeing a much smaller number of patients with a lot more imaging than we're seeing on our side with a much higher number of patients. And my take has been that for some unusual conditions, which we, have gravitated to us as a tertiary referral center, we, saw some real utility in OCTA. It's certainly, there's a lot of information there, but in general, retina practice, you could pretty much make the diagnosis without it almost every time. It is sort of a diagnostic searching for a condition to a certain extent, but it does add a lot. I will say this, the new generation OCTAs are going to change the world. I'm optimistic that they will be widely adopted, wider field, faster acquisition times, more comfortable for the patient, more attention to the outer retinal plexus, the choriocapillaris, the choroid in general. I think there'll be a lot more utility coming around the pike. It'll become less of an academic exercise and more of a widespread utility, but that's a prediction.
Well, I know, like I've heard Phil Rosenfeld say in a couple of talks or meetings too that he gets OCTA on every patient and then extracts the data he needs to, the anatomic images that he needs. So he just gets an OCTA on everybody. And then he gets everything he needs out of that one scan, but we haven't done the
Well, thank goodness for Phil, but Phil is so important to our field, and he's made so many contributions and observations that are, life-changing for the outcomes of a lot of patients. But at the universities, we have resources that you all in the community don't have, and that is younger, smarter trainees that are off and running. Let's talk about the training program there in Columbia. You take fellows, you've had a lot to do with the residency department chair in South Carolina. Let me ask you this. When you're choosing a fellow and or a partner, what are the characteristics that you're looking for in that person?
Obviously you want somebody that just for practical reasons, you want to take a fellow that's been at a training program where he's done a fair amount of surgery because you don't want to get somebody in that, day one, you realize that they can't really operate by themselves. So, that's just a practical thing. Hopefully their surgical experience was very good in their fellowship. But, I think, and I've learned, painfully from some bad experiences, is that you just gotta have somebody who, is willing to help out when needed without complaining and, willing to take on the extra case, willing to see the extra work in, willing to, come in to see the patient when they're on call. And do it without complaining, and be collegial and be supportive, and somebody that is nice and treats staff and patients well. I mean, so I'm just looking for somebody who's polite and considerate and happy to be at work and works without complaining and doesn't get and get mad at people. So it's really kind of that's what I'm looking for.
When you're training fellows and they're making the transition from being a well-trained resident to a vitreoretinal surgeon, what are the takeaways that you're trying to impart to them? Like maybe two or three high-level surgical principles as they transition into a more complex realm of surgery.
I mean, I think one of the major things is just learning the status of the hyoid, knowing how to identify the hyoid and ensuring that you've elevated it off the retina, and removed it, because if you don't do that, you're just asking for all kind of problems. And so that is number one in my book. And the fellow initially, is very tentative naturally, and can be sort of timid about, trying to engage the hyoid, which is natural. But because of that timidity, I think sometimes they don't engage it and they don't get it off. And so that's one thing I emphasize to everybody. The second thing, we've already touched on a little bit, is in diabetic traction detachments, you've got to identify that posterior leaflet, or you're going to be in the wrong plane. And then, just I think the third thing, because I think the hardest thing to do and to learn to do is to peel the ILM, or peel, macular epiretinal membranes. And I think, the one thing I impart to them all the time, if is that the big muscles have to be relaxed for the hands to be still. If you get like this, it's hard to keep your hands from tremoring. So we talk a lot about posture when you're getting ready to operate and having the microscope, at a place where you're not hunched over, you're not doing this, that you're upright, your shoulders are relaxed, and you're, and so just tips for trying, ergonomic tips about how to handle your body and your hands when you're doing surgery so that you don't have a tremor, you don't, and you don't get tired and cramped and fatigued when the case is long.
Those are all great tips. Speaking of teamwork and being happy to go the extra mile, one of the things that's always impressed me is your commitment to organized medicine, both locally in your state with the South Carolina group and nationally with all your advocacy for the academy. Can you speak to what that experience has been like and whether you recommend our listeners, whether they're domestic here in the United States or around the world, why it's been worth it to you to work and interface with your government, your hospitals, your medical school. You've been chairman of the department. You've worked in these National Eye Institute studies, basically volunteering your time at great personal expense. But it's always the more you give, the more you get, the more satisfaction there is. What is it for you? And speak specifically to the organized medicine component of it.
Yeah. So, just so happened that within a year of me arriving back here in Columbia and going into practice in 1993, I came back in 92. So, in 1993, the optometrists introduced a scope of practice expansion bill in the legislature. And, my father was an ophthalmologist, and I was very aware of the optometric issue in ophthalmology, and my father, had complained about optometrists a lot over the years. And I'm not here to denigrate optometrists. I mean, we have a lot of wonderful optometrists in Columbia who do great work, and I think optometrists play a very integral role in eye health care in this country, and they have their role to play. But in 1993, when that bill came out, I got kind of fired up, and I joined the State Ophthalmology Society, and I said, I'll do whatever you ask me to do, and I went down and testified at some hearings at the State House, and it got defeated. And I had a few optometrists say some ugly things to me and say they weren't going to send me patients anymore. And I was like, well, that's the way it goes. But at that point I got involved, and I just decided I wanted to stay involved, and it served us well. Later, my involvement got elevated by a nomination to be in the Academy's Leadership Development Program, which then led to a 5-year appointment to the State Affairs Committee, and then a 5-year appointment to OPFPAC, which is the, federal advocacy arm of the Academy. And so, and all those things were great because, you met ophthalmologists from all over the country. like-minded people, fun people. Meetings were always a blast. And, you made friends and colleagues through these interactions. And I just enjoyed going to Washington every year and going to the mid-year forum, which, most people don't go to the mid-year forum. It's a different kind of meeting. There's a lot of business and economic presentations, a lot of politics, and you sort of get an inside, a better insight into, what's going on in Washington. But I don't know how many people go to mid-year forum every year, but it's, it's a much smaller group. It's not like going to the academy, but I've always enjoyed that meeting. And though I am going this year, I think for the last time, this might be my last stint. And then, when I said earlier that it served us well that I was involved in the state society, when anti-VEGF therapy was first approved, South Carolina had a 7% sales tax on physician-administered drugs. And Lucentis, Avastin, Eylea all fell under that rubric of physician-administered drugs. So we had to pay a 7% sales tax whenever we bought Lucentis, or at the time it was mostly Lucentis. I was like, well, this is terrible. We're going to lose money.
That's like working at the university.
Yeah, I know. So I was like, we can't do this. So we're very Avastin heavy practice. And in 2006, I went to the State Ophthalmology Society director and said, explain the situation to him. And he was like, well, this is, we got to do something about this. So we found a legislator who was sympathetic. We drafted a bill exempting these drugs from the tax and introduced it in the State House. And you know who the first group was to oppose it? Was the South Carolina Medical Association. And we were like, what in the world is, why are they opposing this? And we contacted them and they said, oh no, we can't support this. This is only for ophthalmology, these three ophthalmology drugs. If there's going to be a repeal of the sales tax on physician-administered drugs, it's got to be all drugs, or we're not going to support it. Well, that changed the dynamic because then the Department of Revenue went from saying, oh, we'll lose $3 million in revenue to we're going to lose $50 million in revenue. And then the legislators were like, oh no. So long story short, it took 6 years to finally get that bill passed. And in 2014, we finally had complete elimination of the sales tax and were able to use, Eylea Lucentis, which we weren't able to do.
That's a
And
really incredible journey.
if we hadn't had that relationship with the State Society, I don't think we'd have ever gotten that passed.
Changed a lot of lives getting
Yeah,
access to those
so
drugs.
it's been great. I mean, I've truly enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed being. I resigned as chair of the residency program here at the end of last year, but I was there for 11 years, and it was great. I love being with residents. I love teaching residents. They're young, enthusiastic. This is true. I mean, they ask you questions you don't know the answer to. I mean, all the time. I'm like going, I don't know. I gotta find that out. So it's nice being challenged like that,
Keeps you going. So for people who don't live here in the United States, tell us just a little bit about South Carolina,
So South Carolina.
one of the original colonies.
Yeah, it's one of the original 13 colonies. It's on the southeastern coast. It's just above Georgia. Well, it's next to Georgia and just above Florida. There's a little bit of Georgia coastline in between Florida and South Carolina. And, South Carolina is a small state. It's had a historically small population, though it is growing very rapidly. I'm not sure I'm happy about that. It's got three distinct topographies. There's we call it the low country, which is just the coast and about the next 50 miles in. And then there's the sand belt, which is the middle of the state where I live, which is rolling hills and a lot of pine trees, sandy soil. And then the northwest part of the state, South Carolina is kind of like a triangle. The northwest corner is called the Piedmont, and that's sort of 2,000, 3,000 foot mountains, lots of, hardwood trees, lakes, rivers, very pretty. And the climate here is very, temperate. We don't, though we did have snow about a month ago. We had a snowfall and an ice storm. That happens about once every, I don't know, 10 years. So most of the time it's nice. We play golf year round. It's really hot in the summer, but it's a nice place to visit. Charleston, South Carolina is a beautiful historic city. It's one of the oldest cities in the United States. And has an enormous amount of Revolutionary War history and Civil War history in Charleston. Some people may know that like the first shots of the Civil War were fired in Charleston on Fort Sumter in the Charleston Harbor. So I encourage anybody that comes to America to, come to South Carolina. It's Charleston's beautiful. And other parts of the state too are equally as, fun to visit. So
Well, thank you for that, Jack, and thank you for sharing your experiences and an overview of your career and the things you've taught us. And thank you for advancing our field and being a guest on Retina Rounds today. Really
thanks.
appreciate it.
You know me well. You know if you get me going, I'll talk.
All the best. All right, thanks,
All
Jack.
right. Thank you, Steve. I
Thank
appreciate
you.
it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.